Every year of my life, that's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This February 7, 2017 edition, episode 102 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico and also down south in Belize. Our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Today is also a call-in show, so if you'd like to ask a question of our guest or ourselves, you can call us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Today's guest is Mimi Gurman, and she is a poet and an activist and an organizer for four decades, spanning the meltdown at Three Mile Island in the late 70s, to working in support of the Sandinista movement and against Reagan and his AIDS policies in the 80s, to becoming part of the peace movement in Israel, to circling back to anti-nuke work post-Chernobyl and Fukushima, bringing attention to the insanity of nuclear power since 2016. Is working to get the city of Portland to end homelessness and provide emergency shelter 24/7 to people attempting to survive on the street. She has also started a safety action plan in her small village, which provides immediate support to anyone in her community getting harassed in this new Trump era. Mimi and her partner grow their own food, giving most of it away for free to communities in low-income housing. Mimi does not get paid or receive money for her activist work, and without caring for the most vulnerable, we are nothing but the evil among us. Welcome to NBL on PRN, Mimi Gurman.
Hey, thanks. It's really nice to be hanging out with you two from afar.
Right on.
Thank you very much, Mimi. It's good to be chatting with you after such a very long time. June 2015, we last talked to you on this show.
Yeah, it's been a while. Gone downhill since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, to say the least, right?
if we start right now.
On the show, we generally cover a lot of usually big-time issues, broad-sweeping things like climate change, extinction events, political, economic, global, national catastrophes. And I think sometimes, at least on this show, we miss and overlook the impacts of the industrial model on the most vulnerable within our culture and living within this arrangement. And when we think of places like, you know, Portland, Oregon, or places like Austin, Texas, we often think of progressive policies that are accepting and tolerant. And I was wondering if you could give us kind of an overlook of some of the tragedies that have been happening in your city and the grassroots action that's been taking place to address, you know, the tragedies going on in Portland.
Yeah, sure. And thanks for the opportunity to have me talk about it. It's funny that a lot of people think that Portland is such a hip place to be. If hip is being part of gentrification, then yeah, it's hip. If hip is being part of a mostly white community, yeah, it's hip. If hip is being in support of having protesters not block traffic because it screws up your rush hour drive home, yep, it's hip. If hip is having farm markets almost every day of the week somewhere in Portland where the prices are ratcheted up to 10 to 50 times what they should, you know, what food should cost, yep, it's hip here. It's really hip. If you're in favor of cops beating up protesters, this is a great place to be. If you're in favor of a city that has no rent control, this is a great place for you. So that's really what's going on the day-to-day here. Underneath all of that are my friends, activists who make it their issue to take care of those other issues and in order to try to alleviate the pressures that are put on the most needy among us, the most vulnerable among us. So here we are. We're in the middle of a winter unlike any we've had. We have more people living on the street than ever before, and we have the activist community going out onto the streets with food in their cars, with clothing in their cars, with, you know, volunteer drives in their own neighborhoods to get food and clothing in their cars to take to the people living on the street, because our city doesn't find that, you know, they can't locate their own responsibility for having people on the street and then to take care of those people on the street. So it falls to us. We're always going to do that. And here we are again, where we're trying to bring these issues and answers for alleviating houselessness altogether, and the city refuses to hear us. So we go in as the activist community, we shut shit down as often as we can in order to be heard. What we really want to do is be heard, is have the people who have the ways and means to stop houselessness from happening to do their job. But so far, they're not doing anything. So here we are again, the activist community doing the work of what other people think is the government's job to do.
So I want to be a born-again hipster, Mimi, and it sounds like Portland isn't the place to be after all.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
So can you give us an example of some recent action you've taken as an activist and what it led to, if anything?
We have city council meetings on Wednesdays in our town. And in the last two Wednesdays, I've gone in with friends of mine to bring attention to the fact that we've had five people die on our streets in the last month due to weather, due to freezing weather, due to hypothermia, due to houselessness, due to uncaring, due to heartlessness. And so we've gone into city council to try to get meetings with the people who can change laws and create laws to help protect people. Mm-hmm. And because they don't want to listen to us, we go in with our answers, and we've shut down the last 2 weeks city council. We've shut it down. 2 weeks ago, we shut it down three times in one session. And then following that session, the mayor said to us he would meet with us if we allowed the business of the city to continue for that day during the council. So we had a discussion at that council, those of us who were locked in to the hall, to say, you know, what do we want to do? And I said, well, I really do want to meet with the mayor. I want to give this a try and see if he will do the things that I've come here to ask him to do. I said, but if you guys want to continue to, you know, keep this shut down, then that's your prerogative as well, you know. So we decided that we were going to allow the council to continue and meet with the mayor. So then all the TV cameras were there. Mainstream media, corporate media was there. And on TV, I had the first question to the mayor outside. And I said, you've asked us to work with you, but you don't have the answers. So what I want to know is, are you willing to work with us, we who do have the answers? And he said, yes, I will work with any of you. So what I did following that was the next morning, I made an appointment to meet with the mayor, since he said he would meet with me or any of us. I went through the proper channels, figuring that I'm never going to get a meeting with the mayor, but, you know, I'm going to try. So sure enough, no meeting with the mayor, no meeting with anybody. The calls were blocked. Nobody wanted to answer. I went into City Hall to try to, you know, meet with somebody. Anyway, so we went back the following Wednesday, and we shut it down again. So City Council was shut down 2 weeks in a row. Tomorrow is Wednesday. I'm waiting to hear back again to see if we can get that meeting. And if we don't have that meeting by tomorrow, City Council is going to be shut down again. So one of the things that we've been asking for, and we've been incredibly clear, is that if the mayor would use his power to call on things, certain things to open, for instance, community centers in every neighborhood to have a mandatory opening 24/7 during weather crises. That way, every single community has its own houseless population, and those people can get to a local community center. He hasn't done that. So another idea was shame the churches into opening. Go on television, tell the churches, I can't make you open your doors, but you should be opening your doors so that we have more shelters. He hasn't done that either. He could use, we have a fleet of vehicles in our city that all stay on the doors to these vehicles, the city that works. Use those vehicles to help bring people who are way out, far from any shelter, to get them to the shelters with all of their belongings so that they don't have to leave anything behind, and so that they'll be at least not, you know, hypothermic for a particular evening. So these are some of the suggestions. We have about 10, and so far we've been completely ignored, and I realized last week when I was thrown out, I was actually thrown out of of City Hall, that the only people who the city council will actually create dialogue with are people who are asking for money. So if you're a contractor or if you are a builder, you can have an actual dialogue with the five commissioners on city council. But when we go in to discuss issues that are relevant to life and death, and we don't ask for money because we don't need money, we are completely disregarded and tossed out, and so are the issues that we're bringing to the public's attention. And it's so typical, isn't it? If you're not part of needing a corporate entity to get you through, or if you're not part of needing money to get you through, who needs you?
Yeah. So this level of apathy and disgust, what has been, I guess, you know, because what has been the public response that to what you're doing? Because, I mean, I don't know how much press you're getting. I can't imagine much. But what is outside of the city government, what has been the response to what you're trying to do? Are you meeting resistance from, you know, liberal, progressive-like folks? Is it resistance all the way around?
We get resistance from white people all the way around because we interrupt their flow. And as long as we interrupt the flow, there's going to be resistance from them as to even the issues that we're bringing forward. And one of the things that I've been talking about recently to just my friends is that if you deny that homelessness and houselessness exists, then your world is pretty peachy. You know, and so this is in Portland, again, because it's so hip, people don't talk to people on the street, and therefore, they don't exist. It's just that simple. If I don't talk to you, then you don't exist. So when we go and we bring these issues up, these issues that aren't even, it's almost as though they're incomprehensible to people who have their daily routine based in the corporate world, that we even care. Like, why would you even care about this? So all of these things come into play. And what they'll say is, why can't you let city council go about the city's business? That's the response we get. The city's business.
Right.
And last week, when I was thrown out for the second time, then I was outside the doors of the council. And the mayor came out the second time that that particular session was shut down. The mayor happened to walk out the door that I was standing by. Mm-hmm. And he was so furious. He was exasperated as well, you know, because here he is. He's new. He went to Harvard. He's a trust fund baby. And the bubble that he grew up in is just, it's tightly wound around him. And he came out and he turned to me and he said, you know, we can't get the city's work done when you continue to shut down the council. And I said, you know, we shouldn't be doing anything other than dealing with the people who are dying on the streets and forget about all of the things that the city thinks it needs to do until you deal with the people on the street. And he just huffed and he turned around and he walked away. And I said, this is your fault. And he turned to me and he said, this is not my fault. And I said, this is absolutely your fault. You said you'd have a meeting with us, and you refuse. I went through your channels, and you refuse, and here we are. And we'll continue to do this until you let the people speak.
Wow. I mean, the amount of patience that you have is staggering to me, because the absolute horror of somebody literally not caring that people are dying in his own city because he wants to keep the machine running and he doesn't want to upset, you know, the people that like their daily routine of going to their coffee shops and not having to think about shit. I don't know how you do it. I mean, I would literally be strangling this guy.
I think it's more than that. It's more than just patience. It's stamina to keep showing up time after time after.
Yeah.
It's amazing, and good on you.
Well, I think the difference is that when, and I've seen this happen, I saw it happen with me, and I've seen it happen with others who experienced a very similar thing. because we haven't had a crisis quite like this weather-wise, at least in a very long time, and definitely we've never had one that's lasted this long. And we've also never had one where five people have died on the street. So there's more of us in the activist community who are going out and taking part in these drives to bring people clothing, to check in on them, to basically knock on tents and make sure people are alive and feed them, ask them what they need, take them, you know, and take them to where they need to be, right? When you do that, and you look into the eyes of people who are on the street, who've been on the street for so long, no matter what their story is, no matter the level of addiction, if they are addicted, the level of mental ability or inability to, you know, to be, to live, or just, you know, having been recently thrown out of their house for rent raises, when you meet them and you see them freezing and you see them suffering, there's no way. It's completely life-altering. You can't forget them. You can't go to sleep and not dream them. You can't hear the wind and not think of their tents. You can't think that their box stay dry tonight that they're under. You know, did that overpass protect them? You can't, and you're changed. And it's happened to every single person who's done that. And this is why I just tell people, just please say hello to people you see who are living on the street. Ask them what they need. Ask them if they need anything. Ask them how they are. Can I get you coffee? What's your name? And bring a level of love and caring and empathy and humanity to them, to their existence, because they don't have that.
Yeah.
But Mimi, why? Why do you pursue a life of service when it seems so few in the society are willing to do that? When did it start? When did you become this crazy badass woman? And why do you keep doing it?
It's pretty amazing when you take what you know into the halls of so-called justice, which you know are completely unjust, and you attempt to speak for those people, and you see all your other friends who are so busy doing the work that, you know, others should be doing, that you can't, again, you can't not do that. It circumvents everything else. It makes it difficult for me to go to work that I love doing, you know, doing massage therapy, when the weather's terrible, because I'd like to be out there helping. You know, and that's how we all feel. That's why we're activists. That's what activism is. That's why when we see things that come by the computer and say, sign this, we tend to laugh. Sign what? Why? What is that going to do?
Yeah, I mean, so when tomorrow is another meeting, do you have, and I'm sure, you know, nobody of significance as far as politics in Portland is going is ever going to listen to this, but do you have a strategy of, you know, what happens tomorrow and beyond as far as dealing with the city council and the mayor?
Yeah, we're going to continue doing what we've been doing. I'm calling tomorrow Monopoly Day, and I'm going to bring Monopoly money, and I'm going to ask if I can approach the desk and or whatever they sit behind, their throne, right, and give them all money, Monopoly money. And then I'm going to sit at the table, and I'm going to ask them if they will converse with me now that they have money, and I'll ask for it, and then I'll give it back to them. And then maybe we can discuss the issues of people dying on the street and what our answers are, and when they're going to comply with the answers that we've brought. And if they don't, then we'll just shut it down again.
Yeah. And so really the goal is to continue to shut down until you get a meeting.
That's right. They told us we could have a meeting. So last week I was asked if I wanted to go in and speak with one of the other commissioners. She was someone who was just voted in and by the people. She's actually, I don't know that I'd call her an activist, but she's pretty cool. And she won an election, so she took over just this guy who was just such an asshole, and he really needed to go, and she won. Her name's Chloe Udaly. And Chloe's office came out to me and said, Chloe said that if you would like to come and talk with us about how you see change, you know, occurring, we'll listen to you. So I couldn't go in City Hall anyway because I was thrown out. So I went into Chloe's office, and then some of my activist friends came with me, and we met with two of her staffers for about an hour and a half. And I wrote to one of those staffers yesterday, and I said, so it was a letter of questions. You know, did you do this and did you do this? And you said you were going to do this. So how did that go? And who did you speak to? Because he said he would go and pressure the mayor's office, since Chloe's office doesn't have the power to open more shelters. Only the mayor can do that. So when I wrote to him, his name is Kip, I asked him all this, and his response was as I thought it would be. It was a complete letdown. And it's not that I was let down. I knew that he wouldn't do what he said. So one of the things that he said was, thank you for your follow-up. I never said I was going to meet with the mayor. I said I would bring your concerns to his office. That is in the works. I'll keep you and Star, this is another activist friend, and others up to date as I have progress. I was happy to be able to take time out of my work day in the middle of working on the relocation ordinance efforts to discuss your ideas and concerns. So my response to him was, I believe it was you who said you would pressure the mayor to move forward with our suggestions. That's why we stayed in the meeting with you. And I went on to say, if you have an issue about leaving work to talk to us, take that up with your boss, because she's the one who invited us in. We didn't ask to come in. So we're already being met with this level of pretense and lack of civility, you know,
right,
from those offices, just because we have ideas that do work and they just don't want to do it. And they want to take their time, as if the people on the street have time. And everyone is under this contextuality of life as we've got all the time in the world, because people living on the street have been so dehumanized as to no longer exist.
Right.
So this is where we're at.
Wow.
Right.
I mean, so obviously this isn't just a problem for Portland. I mean, for, you know, last question on this particular subject, and I want to ask you a couple other things about nukes, but for our listeners, you know, people living all over the world in different cities and different locations, I know you spoke earlier about talking to people who are on the streets and making eye contact with them and asking if they need anything. What else have you learned that you could pass on to our listeners that they could do in their own cities or their own townships?
Well, when you talk to people on the street and you have a moment to do that, use the moment wisely. Ask them how it's working for them. How are they getting their needs met through the city programs that exist? And if they aren't, why? What's going on? Who is it that they need to hear from who they haven't heard from? What office is supposed to be dealing with that? You know, who are the social workers who are supposed to be taking care of them? You know, do they have family anywhere? Is it, you know, like, again, humanizing the situation. Last week I took a couple who were from the shelter here in my village downtown so they could get the bus to go somewhere else that they needed to go to sell newspapers, because we have a wonderful group here of people who write for a newspaper, and they sell their newspapers, and it's called Street Roots. And these are people who live on the street, and they make their own money. And so the papers that they sell, they keep that money. So anyway, I took this couple to downtown. And it was during, you know, this weather crisis. And I had a moment to ask them what was going on. And the woman is pregnant and has a lot of mental disabilities. And I said to her, are you seeing a doctor? And she said, I have a doctor. I said, are you seeing a doctor? And she said, no. And I said, why? Well, they don't treat me well, you know. And you find these things out by asking the questions. And I said, are you taking vitamins? Yes. Do you have them with you? Yes. Can I see them? You know, just making sure that this stuff is happening to protect the fetus, right? And I said to her, do you need help getting to the doctor? And her husband is really supportive. And he said, no, I can get her there. You know, it's just that she doesn't want to go. And so you talk, you just talk and say, you know, do you need assistance with that? Can I help you with that? So that's one thing. Then there's a hub in cities that have any kind of help for the houseless. And that hub is usually a place where you can ask for assistance for this, that, or the other thing. So I said, ours here is, I forget what it's called, TP something. And I said, how is that place working for you? And they groaned. And they said, you have to wait all day with hundreds and hundreds of other people in a waiting room, and everyone's sick because they're living on the street, you know, and they never call your name. And then when they call your name, they're rude to you. And it's this, it's basically like the prison system, except there's no cages.
Right.
And you wait to just find out that the help that you're supposed to get isn't going to come, or, you know, they won't treat you right. And because people have dehumanized people on the street, they've also, they have a lack of understanding that people on the street have hearts. They feel things, you know? So if they're treated with disrespect, they feel that. And if they're treated as people who are less than, they feel that, and they're not going to want to go and receive the things that they need. So this is why they are the most vulnerable of any population anywhere.
Yeah, thank you for bringing this attention to what's actually happening in Portland, and hopefully people listening to the show will start to kind of look at their own particular circumstance in the cities and the towns that they live in, because it's everywhere. And, you know, I was thinking through this entire interview, the way that I've carried myself through the world and seeing people on the streets and how I've acted at times, and just the callousness that I've developed from living in, a culture that, you know, kind of develops this callous throughout our entire lives, and, you know, things we don't want to see or face that make us uncomfortable. So thank you for bringing this to us. I do want to talk to you before we let you go about what's happening at Fukushima, because it was reported by the Guardian, amongst other places, that the radiation levels are as high as they've ever been since the meltdown in reactor number 2. And I was wondering if you wanted to talk a little bit about what's going on there, or, you know, your thoughts on the nuke industry in general.
It doesn't need to be long. The nuke industry in general, it's going to come under pressures that it's never seen before, or the likes of which they've never seen before, and that is all due to weather. We've had now in the United States, we've had nukes that were shut down from floods, nukes that were shut down from icy pipes, nukes that were shut down from overheating due to hot weather. We've had generators go out and access to electricity go down because of winds. So every single thing, and snow, every single thing that can happen with weather has shut down a nuke plant in the U.S. And as you both know, this is going to get exponentially worse. Excuse me. So I know that we're going to see a meltdown in the United States. The question is when and how quickly. And I think it's going to be really quick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Guy. Like, I'm sorry.
You know, we've seen this coming for a while. This is what collapse looks like. And when civilization collapses, and we're seeing obvious cultural decay at this point, these are the kinds of things that happen. We just can't keep up anymore. We don't have enough money. We don't have enough materials to deal with what used to be minor inconveniences, and they have become, within the last decade or so, no longer minor inconveniences. They are major issues that affect the lives of many people. And you're seeing in Portland, we're seeing in Fukushima, for people who are paying attention, they're seeing it in their hometown too. It's pretty difficult to get away from that. I want to transition a little bit and wind down our conversation with you, Mimi, by bringing up something a little bit more personal, and that's your poetry. You, as I understand it, only recently started writing poetry, although you've been a musician for a very long time, writing a different kind of song. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Why poetry? Why is things are falling apart culturally, are you expanding your own intellectual and cultural horizons and doing things differently than you were doing before?
I don't think that we have a language in English that's capable, in a speaking or conversational format, that's capable of addressing the depth of collapse that's necessary. and at least I can't find it. I can find my own, in a way, reassurances, my own alliances by through art, whether it's in a painting or a poem or a song or music with no words, whatever it might be. Those are the things that help me to first feel better sometimes or feel aligned with other times what is happening. And I just moved my, I guess my creativity just moved from songwriting back into poetry. And I'm able for me now to have that form of expression so that the lid that we all live under, our own personal lid that can make us explode, it helps me keep my lid off. It helps me let my steam out and express how I'm feeling in a way that I can't do any other way.
Wow, that's fantastic. For me, it's writing and it's speaking, but I'm moving more into an artistic space myself as those things are kind of running their course, and I can appreciate the poetry, and I do a little myself, but it seems to help me breathe, if anything else.
Right.
With the madness.
Right, I understand.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, thank you, Mimi, for spending some time with us, as always, and your voice. Mimi Gurman is a poet, an activist, an organizer, and one kick-ass human being, and thank you for coming on the show. We're honored to have you.
Thank you very much.
Brothers. You take care.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Okay, we're going to go to some callers. We have Richard. Is Richard on the line?
Richard from Germany.
Yes, I am. I don't know how this thing works, but we'll try it out.
Okay, go ahead, Richard. We can hear you.
Okay, good. Mike's guy's there, too, from what I understand. Following up on Mimi is pretty difficult at this point. I live in Germany, so it's a whole different world. Guy was in Europe for a while, and I think he stopped off of Germany, among other places. And I'm curious as to how he, well, his impression of there versus there being the West Coast of the United States. I'm a resident of Washington State, Seattle, so I know both sides. But I'm interested in Guy's impressions regarding Northern Europe, where he was visiting.
Well,
is that fair?
That's interesting. I guess that's a question, or similar question, almost everywhere I go, especially if I go outside of the United States. Was it different here? Is the reaction somehow different than when you speak in the United States? And actually in Western Europe, it was notably different. That was 2 years ago, and there was a higher level of acceptance than I had been experiencing in the United States. But to be fair, the evidence continues to grow underlying my message. And so it seems that the most recent tour is the one that there is greater acceptance. I was impressed when I was in Wales in particular and speaking to college-age students, ages 16 to 22 approximately. And afterward, the vast majority of the 60 or 80 students who were there were demonstrating tremendous glee. They were skipping across the dance hall as if they were 7 years old. They were smiling. They were making jokes. They wanted pictures taken with me and with each other. I got the impression that they knew at some level what was going on. And as several of them told me, they felt like they'd been lied to most of their lives. And they knew there was something wrong, and they were unable to articulate it. And I brought that out. I was able to articulate it. And so I went, just a big sigh of relief. Oh, well, of course. And of course our lives are short. And of course we should pursue what we love instead of what our parents think will make us the most money. So the trend continues in that direction. I'm not sure if it was Western Europe or the timing, because it still continues in that direction. Thanks for the great question.
Excellent. All right, we're moving on to the next caller, Ariel. Ariel, are you there?
Yes. Wow, so much to say, but wow, Mother Nature is shutting them down. shut their nukes down. That's how I got into this whole activism with this nuclear issue, and it is just the most frightening thing that I could ever imagine. And now with the geoengineering, and I've heard Guy McPherson speak on Gary Noll's show. Thank you all for all the wonderful work you're doing. Mimi, I don't know if she's still listening, but just so appreciative. I remember I was with a bunch of homeless people at some event where we were all walking around, and there was this couple I was talking to, and his man and wife were there, and they were saying, "We have each other, that's all we need." And it was like, wow, that was amazing. But my question is about the chemtrails and the nukes and all of the radiation and the poison that's going on. Even if we could stop it now, is there any way that we could, that it could be neutralized? I heard that there are some plants that eat radiation, but I don't know about all these other things, and I'm just really scared out of my wits about all of this. So whichever one of you wants to answer that, you're fine.
Well, I mean, my short answer is I don't see any sort of way of stopping what's happening and what's going on. I mean, Fukushima is a perfect example as far as, you know, nukes go. You know, we had a meltdown that happened in 2011. It's 2017, and we're seeing radiation levels that are as high as they were when the meltdown occurred. So that tells me we don't know what we're fucking doing, and we are just spinning the story. And Guy and I actually experienced this the other day. I think what we experienced on our PRN page is we had professional trolls from, you know, who were supporting nuclear energy, and they spent time, and I had nothing better to do, so I engaged with them for, you know, an hour or so back and forth. And the interesting thing was we couldn't actually block them off our page. We tried to search them within the membership. We tried to find them to so we could, you know, after a few minutes, it was like ridiculous. So we tried to get rid of them and we couldn't do it. And, you know, they had no idea what the page or our show was about. And when we started bringing up the things we were talking about, they thought they were ridiculous because they had never actually thought of those things. And so I think we're so caught up in this narrative of trying to fix and negotiate and trying to, you know, keep this all going and juggling it, that, you know, anything outside of that, like, you know, acceptance of the situation we are in is looked at as crazy. And you know, Guy can tell you as well as anybody, when he walks into some audiences, they think he's a lunatic. So, Guy, you want to talk about that a little bit?
Am I lunacy? I don't think we need to bring that up on the air, do we? No, you're absolutely right. And we have sort of a running joke on this show, Ariel. Mike, at least once an episode, says, if we start right now, and it's a joke because we aren't starting right now. We've had this show in the air for 2.5 years now, something like that, and we haven't started right now. We haven't started, you know, that's the common response we get is, yeah, but that's a problem. It's not a predicament. If we start right now, we're going to be able to do these things. And we now know, based on the Referee Journal literature, which is an incredibly conservative set of sources, that civilization itself is a heat engine. We know what civilization does. The industrial civilization drives species to extinction every day. It is responsible for the fouling of the air and the dirtying of the water, and on the list goes. And yet, nobody wants to change it up. Nobody wants to create a different set of living arrangements, at least people who are enjoying the privileges that come with civilization. So it's omnicide writ very large. It's a heat engine writ very large. We aren't going to start right now. We aren't going to turn this thing around. It's done. It's game over. What's in is in. So, and what is in seems to me a minimum of 8.5 degrees Celsius or so above the 1750 baseline within a decade, and 4 degrees Celsius above baseline probably drives us to extinction. So I don't think we have long, and I think this is all beyond our control. That's not to suggest, and neither Mike nor I have ever suggested, that we just roll over and die.
the notion that we propose inaction is not supported by any evidence. Mike, do you want to comment a little bit on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. The other day I posted some pictures of me at a Super Bowl party. Actually, it was just pictures of pizza that Karen had made. And I got this Facebook message from somebody who, you know, I couldn't look up. And it's one of those where they're not my friend, so you can either ignore or accept the message. I could read the message, and I chose to ignore it because the message was that, you know, it basically says, Sliva, you're full of shit. You're watching the Super Bowl as you tout the bringing down of industrial civilization. And the absolute disconnect between people I literally was going to write this person back, but I'm like, I'm not getting into this. But, you know, if that person is listening, I also drove a car to the Super Bowl party. I also had a beer in a, you know, a bottle. And I also, you know, had modern clothing on. So it's one of those what I call liberal progressive kind of mindsets where, you know, everybody thinks, well, if I don't watch the Super Bowl, therefore things will be different, or I can't call for the bringing down of something that's horrific and evil around the world without participating in it at the same time. There is no, you know, I could choose not to watch the Super Bowl, but, you know, I chose to hang out with some friends and eat some good food and watch the game. That doesn't mean that I don't think industrial civilization should come down because of the, you know, things we don't see and all the people that and species that are dying because of it. So it's an odd thing. People can, like, I think what Mimi is doing is something that is desperately needed. We talk in these grand schemes, and or our action is not to watch a Super Bowl or not to drive in a car, when actually there are people suffering right in front of us daily that could be, you know, talked to and helped, and we tend to ignore it. And I'm as guilty as anyone. So I think our personal action is so far off. It's so, I guess, it's that story we tell ourselves about ourselves. We'll, you know, yeah, we won't shop at Walmart, but we also won't talk to homeless people. And so it's overwhelming. You know, we can't just sit back and watch it go away. And I'm not asking people to do that. But at the same time, you have to accept certain things and then take action that you see and feel in your heart is right. And I think Mimi was a perfect example of that. Mickey Z, if you ever follow him online, he's doing the same thing. He's helping people, women who are homeless in New York City. He's actually out there doing something. And I think the Doomer community can learn a lot from those two.
Absolutely. And it's not as if we haven't done anything ourselves. It's the monetary system that has driven us to the brink. And we both opted out for the most part, to the ever extent possible. I mean, you walked away from your job that you loved and that you were good at. I walked away from my job that I loved and that I was good at. And we are living differently. We are living in a way different than at least 90% of the people we know, at least that I know. And so, you know, of course, at some level, we're all hypocrites. Yeah, of course. We are human beings. So by definition, we take acts. We take actions that are hypocritical. So shoot me, whatever.
Yeah, it's one of those, you know, it's those battles you choose to fight. And I'm happy with the battles I've chosen. And, you know, you've chosen a similar path. We're both doing things that we feel are better. They feel better to us in the way we're living our lives. And on some level, it's a way of keeping our sanity is the way I look at it. Like Mimi said with poetry, that this is the way I'm living now makes me feel better, and it also keeps me sane.
Right. And that's all we can do, really. I mean, we can try all we want, but you and I, powerful though we are not going to turn civilization around, I'm afraid. So this is what we're stuck with. Desiree from New York, are you still on the line? And do you have a question or comment for us, please?
Yeah. Hi. I had a question. Wanted to say thank you so much for all the information that you're bringing out to as many people who can get this information. My question was, for people who want to make changes, not drastic changes, but I guess to prepare for things ahead, like looking up agriculture, looking up how to farm, how to grow, where I guess to relocate. What are some safe places? Just the other day, I heard someone mention that the topsoil in the United States is horrible, and they said that there's aluminum in the soil, and it's not growable or it's not sustainable. What are some things that people can keep in mind for, you know, years ahead? And what could they do now? What could they stock up on? What can they start growing now? I hope that's my question. Thank
you. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for the question, Desiree. You know, there are thousands of actions each of us takes every day. And I guess the first thing I would do is encourage people to think about each of those actions. When I was working on campus and I'd get up and put my dress clothes on every day before going to teach, I would look at the label, see where it came from. I still bought clothes from Indonesia. I still participated in a system that essentially created slaves in Indonesia so that I could wear cheap clothing in my classroom, but at least I knew about it. What else? Well, you can grow food. You can boycott various products or not. You can reduce consumption in any number of ways. And again, I think those are all ways to make yourself feel better. And had we collectively done those things at the scale of 340 million people, approximately the population of the United States, had we done that in the 1960s and the 1970s, we might have turned the ship around and given ourselves a little bit longer and maybe not fouled the planet so absolutely horrifically. But we didn't. And even if we as individuals take those actions today, which I encourage taking those actions that won't make the situation worse than it already is, I still don't think we're going to turn the ship around, because I think the ship already hit the Titanic. It's going down, and the people who are benefiting the most are those in the front, because the hull is a little higher above the ocean than it used to be, so it looks like there's no problem at all. Mike, you probably have something to say as well.
Well, I think you hit it on the nose when you talked about looking at the labels in your clothes. That's just, as cliche as it sounds today, that's just a way of being mindful and actually paying attention to what you're putting on instead of just putting it on. And I think really that's what Guy and I have tried to do over the last 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years of our lives since we left our jobs, is really starting to pay attention to the choices we make instead of just mindlessly showing up to a job and going there until retirement kicks in and hopefully you get something, you know, at the end of this monotonous struggle. And so, yeah, the things I'm doing – growing food and, you know, living simply and living in community. Those are things I think that help ease suffering. But I also think the reason I'm doing them is because ultimately I feel better. I feel better about my life, and they just feel good physically and emotionally. I like waking up where I am every day. And I like the fact that I know where, you know, a large portion of the food comes from, not all the time. I'm moving towards the exit of the industrial model on food, probably never get there. But those things, I'm not so worried about where I am and what the topsoil is necessarily like, although there are smarter choices than others. Obviously, you don't want to, you know, poisoning yourself. But it's really about just spending time in those moments and making choices that you think collectively ease suffering and at the same time can keep your sanity and make you feel good, because, you know, no one here gets out alive, and whether it's collapse, climate change, or anything else, that's the way it goes. So we have probably time for one more caller. 888-874-4888. It's a toll-free call, 888 number. So if you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call. Guy, real quick, I wanted to mention – in the Thursday, January 19th, 2017 edition of the New York Times, that liberal bastion of news, the headline was, "For the third year, the Earth in 2016 hit record heat." So if if that's not a tipping point, I don't know what is.
Yes. Well, it's maybe a tipping point in terms of human consciousness, but because it does appear in the mouthpiece of Empire. But a little late to the party. We have Bill. Bill from Wisconsin, you got a quick question for you? Because we have time for a quick answer. Go for it.
Yeah, I wanted to thank you guys for your wonderful work. I've been waking up to this over the last decade. And now that I kind of feel like the science is pretty settled, I'm having some issues as to who I should, whose day I should ruin. I want to communicate this with my parents. You know, my dad's a farmer. I work on a farm. It's industrial agriculture. And I just can't bring myself to bring the topic up at the lunch table. What's your recommendations?
Don't.
And sorry, we don't have time to answer that question. We're going to have to go off the air now.
Right. Yeah. I hear you.
That's a great question. It has been because of the choices I made and the way I expressed myself in making those choices, I have lost almost all the relationships from my former life. So I would not suggest taking that route. At what point do we agree that we have to tell the truth, that we have to present the evidence to people, or we're being dishonest, and balance that with don't be an asshole? Because that seems to be the balancing act to me.
Yeah, I agree. It's a tough balancing act. I mean, it's one of those you have to really walk that line and know potential reactions that you're going to receive and how you're going to react to those. Because if you're defensive and you're making them feel slighted and anything like that, that's not a good way to, from experience, it's not a good way to go. So I would really consciously think about potential ways your folks are going to react to what you're about to present to them, because and how you're going to react based off that, because that's everything.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's tough. You know, I try to start with questions, but it isn't long before I cross that Rubicon and I become the most undesirable person in the room. And I strongly suspect, Bill, that you're better at this than I am, because there's almost no way you couldn't be. But tread lightly.
Yeah, tread lightly is great advice. And you know, it's one of those things. I ask myself this question when I'm going to bring it up to people. You know, is it for me? Am I bringing it up for me because I'll feel better by telling them? Or is it really for them? And if it is for them, is it really going to help them? Or is it just going to put, you know, some stress in their lives that maybe they don't need at this point? You know, and it depends. You know, my parents are in their 70s and, you know, I have to look at, do I really want to put this burden on them in the last, you know, whatever point, you know, years of their lives that they're thinking about this? They're going to die anyway. It's a tough one. I tend not to bring it up that as much as I used to, because quite frankly, it is exhausting.
And it's challenging.
It is.
Because of that balancing, I almost never need to bring it up. Even when I show up at a meeting, I was at the monthly meeting of Pro Organic Belize a week ago today, and some guy comes up to me and says, "You're that guy McPherson." And so, you know, we started this conversation. I heard you moved here, but then we agreed it couldn't be that guy McPherson. And so, I almost never need to bring it up. It just brings itself up, and I try to take defensive action at this point.
Yeah. Now that I have a book, I can just hand that to people. It seems to be the way to do it, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap it up, folks. We want to thank, obviously, Mimi Gurman for calling in and giving us her time and her wisdom, and also for the callers today. That was a lot of great questions and a lot of great insight, and we always enjoyed the callers, so thanks for that. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network. Join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show. Continue to follow Guy's work and his blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. You can follow me at the Good Men Project every Sunday. And now you can order an electronic version of my book, Chasing a Different Carrot, on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Google Books. Paperback version should be out next month.
We also have a fellow Doomer who is looking for a partnership on a film that is very Doom-like, and you can go to vimeo.com and hashtag RGOPALAN, and I'll post that link on our pages. And he's looking for partners to work on this film. And we'll see you on the radio next month, March 7th, 2017. If you missed the show, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN, rate us on iTunes, or find us on Stitcher.com. Thanks again, Mimi, and for your calls this week, and Apprezen for his music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
nature bats last.
Mother Nature, she's gonna get you.